The road is America's preeminent symbol of freedom, and this is understood by consumers of American culture all over the world, writes author Richard Grant. As I write this, a street urchin in Kathmandu, a merchant banker in Bonn, and a failed pimp in Caracas are all dreaming about driving across America in a pair of Levi's and a fast car. Richard Grant's dream started in a dreary British winter. He came to the United States at the age of 22 and started west in an aging burgundy sedan with three friends. That trip began 18 years ago and never really stopped. He describes his experiences and the people he's met along the way in a book called American Nomads, Travels with Lost Conquistadors, Mountain Men, Cowboys, Indians, Hobos, Truckers, and Bull Riders. Does part of you secretly yearn to drop everything and hit the road? If you feel the wanderlust, or if you've given yourself over to it, call and tell us why. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And Richard Grant joins us now from our bureau in New York. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hello, Neil.
It's interesting. You write that when you and your friends finished that trip across the country, 18 years ago and got to Los Angeles, they felt that they'd reached a destination. You felt you just ran out of road.
Yeah, exactly. I just looked for the first excuse to turn around and start driving east again.
How come?
It was just the feeling of being loose and free and in motion. It just I just felt like I'd found a part of me that had been missing somehow. I just felt right.
How was that different from the experience you had in England just before you left?
Well, England, especially in the winter, can be very drab and constrictive, and you don't see the sky for... I remember that particular winter, I didn't see the sky for about 6 weeks on end. And I just felt claustrophobic, like I was sealed in this damp little grey box, and I just really wanted to break free of it.
As it happens, I was actually in England in that particular winter, and I can testify the colour of the sky varied from dark grey to dark.
I think there's about 100 different shades of grey that the English sky can go,
and none of them involve the colour blue. But as you arrived in the Great Plains of America, you saw a sky you'd never seen before.
Yeah, in my foolishness, I'd assumed all skies in the world were more or less the same. But I was out on the high plains of Texas, West Texas, and the sky seemed to have... I'd been driving all night, and it seemed like the sky had doubled or tripled during the night. It just felt dwarfing. It felt enormous, and I felt giddy and elated. I loved the feeling of being able to see for 50 miles.
And yet, a sky you'd never seen before, that at the same time you experienced a sense of déjà vu.
I spent part of my childhood in the Middle East, in Kuwait, in a desert. And I used to like to go to this place called the Escarpment. It's just basically a rock sticking out of a big, wide, flat, sandy desert. And I used to like to sit up there as a kid and look out over the desert. So maybe that was where the déjà vu came from.
Now, as you experienced this feeling, you decided it was a part of you. It didn't go away. You spent much of the last, 15 years or so traveling the roads in the western part of the States.
Yeah, it was never a planned thing. I just I never really seemed to look more than about 3 weeks ahead, and it always seemed like a good idea to keep moving. So I did, and I found a way to pay for it by writing magazine stories, and that worked out fine. You know, there was always another story to be done, and it was always somewhere else, and so I could live a kind of quasi-nomadic life that way.
And you came to the conclusion that the one rule to happiness was never stay in one place longer than 2 weeks.
That was sort of in my first flush of youthful nomadism. I don't look at it as cut and dried anymore, but for a while that was definitely my operating principle.
There's a, you know, all of us have a, you know, sort of a romantic view, at least at times, of this kind of life. Is that the way you saw it?
At first, yeah. I mean, it feels most romantic when you're on the first kind of escape from whatever humdrum situation you've been trapped in, and you've kind of got your music on your car stereo, and you're just striking out. I've been traveling around for about 18 years now, and some of the romance has definitely faded. It's more just become normal. But I still don't like living a settled life.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@npr.org. We're talking with Richard Grant about American nomads and the lure of the road. Our first caller is Elizabeth, who joins us from San Francisco.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to share, I took my two children, my four-year-old son and my six-year-old daughter across country this summer. We did 16 states in 14 days, and we went to Laura Ingalls Wilder sites. I used it as a theme to get them excited.
And how did they take to the road?
You know, they took to it really well. We did part by Amtrak, which was much better than the driving part, actually, because they could get up and run around. But they really liked it. They complained a little at the time, but they're ready to do it again this summer.
So it had certain attractions.
It did. They loved being on the train. That was very exciting. And they loved getting out and running around. You know, one of the sites we went to was in Minnesota, one of the Laura Ingalls Wilder homesteads. Mm-hmm. And they got out and ran around in the prairie, and they just thought it was great.
Well, of course, those books are at least, you know, a large part of them is about the settlement of the American West, that all those people had the wanderlust to move from the East Coast out to places like you saw.
Well, yeah, and we had been reading Little House on the Prairie, and they had read with me about how the girls sat day after day after day in a wagon going from Wisconsin to Kansas Territory. And it was amazing to them, I think, to see how large the country was and how long it took even in a car.
Well, have a great time when you try it again next year.
Thanks. I can highly recommend it for others.
Elizabeth in San Francisco, thanks very much for the call. And Richard Grant, I mean, one of the things you did was go back and sort of examine the history of American wanderlust, not just the settlers that she wrote about in Little House on the Prairie, but you go back to a Spanish conquistador that you use as an example.
Yeah, I mean, this is the first travel book we have about America. It was written by this Spanish conquistador, Cabeza de Vaca. And he got shipwrecked in Florida, I think, 1527. Shipwrecked in Texas. And he walked all the way across the country to Mexico.
I think you're right. It was Florida, and he walked all the way around through Texas down into Mexico.
Yeah, I think there's actually two ship journeys. But anyway, he took a long, long walk for about 8 years. And it turned into this strange religious procession. He had thousands of Indians that thought he was a holy man. And by the time he'd got to Mexico and rejoined Spaniards, he'd gone native. He couldn't stand the feeling of shoes on his feet. He would sleep in a buffalo hide at night. And when he went back to Spain, he never got used to basically being a European. He'd become an American in a way, and he'd also become a wanderer. And so that's where I kind of chose to start the historical aspect of my book.
As I'm sure you know, he ended up in South America and ended up on another epic journey.
Yeah, he all the time he was in Spain, he was just angling for another trip to the New World, even though he'd been through incredible hardships. And he managed to get command of this expedition to Paraguay. And the established route was to go up rivers, but he got to the coast and he kicked off his shoes and he led his men on a 1,000-mile march overland. And didn't lose a man, didn't kill any Indians on the way. He's basically a failure as a conquistador. He's too nice a guy.
Interestingly, you look at the motives that we and sometimes history put on people like this particular conquistador and the explorers and the settlers, and we all say that they were there for these various reasons. You've come to the conclusion that a lot of them were there just because they liked to wander.
I'm certainly for the explorers. I mean, if you look at the settlement of the American West, and you had these kind of roaming fur trappers, explorers, guys like Kit Carson, and they were basically fleeing civilization. They thought civilization was too confining, too constrictive, and they kept going west to get away from it. And civilization kept catching up with them, but we've kind of got the notion that they were blazing a trail for civilization. Well, I think it was more they were running away from it.
Here's an email question. I suppose the obvious and perhaps naively Freudian question is if your guest feels that he's in any way avoiding maturity or attempting to prolong a sort of adolescent fantasy by his nomadism.
Fair question. I am married now. It was a somewhat tortuous courtship, as you can imagine. I think the difference between doing this now as opposed to doing this 200 years ago was that we're not accustomed to raising families on the move anymore. I did meet a truck driver that I wrote about that he had his family in the truck with him. They homeschooled the child through the internet. But yeah, on the whole, I think it's difficult to raise families when you're in motion.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Alan, who's with us from Tempe, Arizona.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
I just heard you mention the name Jack Kerouac, and a book was lent to me about 4,000 or 5,000 miles ago, which is probably the reason why I have 4,000 or 5,000 more miles on my car. And it's just interesting to read back then. It made me want to go out and, you know, explore the world road trip style. But it's a lot harder to do now as far as everything's more modern and, you know, more all the cities are more grown up. I was just wondering your views on how you can kind of take in that presence in such a modern world.
Richard Grant?
I'd say avoid the cities. look for the backwaters. Look at the big blank spaces on the map and go there. And there's still a lot of them in Nebraska and the American West in general.
Isn't it interesting, if you read Kerouac, though, he will describe how he thinks it's all been ruined and it's different now and it's not as good as it used to be. That's the eternal opinion, isn't it?
Yeah, well, right. certainly people have been saying that a lot since about 1860. I mean, the fur trappers were the first nostalgics for the freedom of the American West. They thought it was all ruined by about 1840. And then the cowboys, you know, they rode around on the open range, and then that was fenced off, and then apparently it was all over by then. And then the, you know, Depression-era hobos, when that all ended, they're like, oh, you know, the freedom's gone, there's no point wandering around. And then you have Kerouac, another nostalgic, and it goes on and on.
Well, Alan, did you enjoy your trip?
Oh, yes, I had a great time. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. Let's see if we could get one more call in before the break. Mike is with us where are you, Mike, in Utah?
I'm in the Beaver Dam Wilderness Mountains of Utah, southwest Utah.
And what are you doing there?
I'm on a road trip right now. I have a 71 Volkswagen camper bus, and I do this every year. I just tour the southwest. It's too hot down here in the summers, so we take off for the winters, the dog and I, and we just try to hike the tallest peaks we can.
Sounds a little like John Steinbeck's old Travels with Charlie.
Yeah, I guess so. But I do this every year. I'm a carpenter. I live in kind of a rural Idaho up in the mountains, and the winters are, we usually get a lot of snow. So I usually take off October, November, and I usually return sometime in April or May.
What's the, other than the weather, what's the lure of the road?
Solitude.
And what do you find out about yourself?
I've been doing this for a long time, Neil. I have no surprises for myself. I love to be alone, although I love the company of my friends. But I just like being out and hiking and just kind of wandering around, whether it be behind the wheel or putting one foot in front of the other, hiking some peak.
What's your dog's name?
His name is Canyon.
We'll let you and Canyon get back to it then.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate the phone call.
Okay, bye-bye.
And when we come back from a break, we'll continue speaking with Richard Grant about the American nomad. Do you know anyone who's given up the house or the white picket fence for a life on the road? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about what the land of the free means to Richard Grant, the author of American Nomads, Travels with Lost Conquistadors, Mountain Men, Cowboys, Indians, Hobos, Truckers, and Bull Riders. Are you an American nomad or do you know one? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And Richard Grant, I'm curious about your use of the word nomads. It suggests a tribe or tribes.
I think, strictly speaking, if you use the strict academic definition, a nomad is a wandering pastoralist, a grazer of livestock. But I think nowadays that the word's got a broader meaning. The definition I used was that a nomad doesn't feel stable when stationary. He only feels stable when experiencing velocity. So that was my working definition.
And there are sort of subsets. This is not just one big group.
No, a lot of, I mean, there is a quasi-tribal aspect to the different subcultures that wander around. And a lot of them are mutually hostile as well. I mean, I took to be nomads the retirees in their RVs that circle the country year-round. I took them to be a nomadic subculture. But they have a lot of conflict with the kind of hitchhiking tramps that tend to show up in some of the same locations. So I look at it, yeah, I guess you could use the word tribe, tribal subcultures. A lot of different ones wandering around out there, and sometimes they clash, and mostly they don't get along with each other.
One of the people Richard Grant writes about in his book is named Lance Grabowski. He's a modern-day mountain man, and he joins us now from his home in Cerrillos, New Mexico, and good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
All right, thank you.
You're probably one of the few people in this book that actually has a home.
Probably. After I've read the book, I think I probably am one of the few people.
What's a mountain man?
Well, a mountain man originally was a hunter and trapper in the early 1800s in the Rocky Mountains, mostly hunting beaver.
Jim Bridger, Kit Carson, those kind of guys?
Those kind of guys, yes.
And what's a modern mountain man like?
Well, a modern mountain man is somebody that does the same thing or something as close to as he possibly can. And that's what I've been doing for the last 37 years. I've taught at the University of Kansas. I worked for National Geographic. I worked for the National Park Service, all of which were things that were one way or another pertaining to the mountain men. And then one day I just decided, this is it. I'm going to do this full time and do it like they did, and got on horseback and spent 2 years wandering around the country horseback.
And you could still do that.
To a degree, yes. You're limited by lots of rules and regulations and fences, but if you want to ignore all that, you can get away with most anything if you want to gamble a little bit.
Are there others like you?
There's a few out there, I believe. I don't really know too many. I think there might be a half dozen in the country, and most of them are staying quietly hidden somewhere and living it probably even more closely than I do.
So how do you survive as a mountain man?
Well, when I'm on the road, I can live off the land. Otherwise, I model for most of the major Western artists in the country, supply them with props, movie companies, museums, interior decorators, art galleries. I make things and sell them, and to hobbyists as well.
So, in a sense, there's an element of modeling of this.
Yes. Yeah, I've modeled for, like I said, most of the major artists over the last 30-some years. Major oils to calendars and book covers and everything else.
So we could take it that you look the part.
Yes.
I'll second that.
Well, how would you describe him, Richard Grant?
Well, the first time I met Lance, he was wearing an ensemble of fringe buckskin leggings and a buckskin jacket with, I think, porcupine quill embroidery. Has a big mustache, longish hair, was wearing moccasins. He was in a rigorously authentic 1820s tent with, I think, buffalo skulls and other buckskin clothing. And it was up at a mountain man reenactment rendezvous up in the mountains of Colorado. And pretty much everything up there was authentic 1820s gear. I think there was a few hidden beer cans, but that was about it.
Other than those rendezvous, Lance Grabowski, doesn't sound like you have much of a social life.
Not too much, no. I'm fairly quiet and hermit-like in many occasions, although I do enjoy getting out once in a while.
Is it still possible, you say you live off the land when you can, is that still, you know, there are a lot of rules and regulations that a lot of people have to follow, don't they?
Being a modern-day mountain man is basically illegal, but then being a modern person in most respects, I think, is illegal these days. Too many rules and regulations.
Lance Grabowski, good luck to you.
Why, thank you.
Lance Grabowski, a modern-day mountain man, and he joined us from his home in Cerrillos, New Mexico. And interesting story, Richard Grant, not the only one you found in your book.
No. I mean, I think when you get down to it, if you have a sort of nomadic inclination, it's your belief that wandering around as free from rules and regulations as you can is the most amount of freedom that it's possible to gain in a modern context. I mean, I think that's really why most people do it, is they want as much freedom as possible. Freedom is more important to them than security. I'm talking about freedom in a very fundamental way. I'm not talking about free trade or electoral politics. I'm talking about freedom from any kind of constriction or regulation.
You also mentioned in your book that we asked Lance Grabowski about his social life. Most of these nomads are men.
Most of them are men. Most of the women that you find out there are either teenagers or they're over the age of 60. There's a lot of women over 60 roaming around out there, living in motorhomes and RVs. I think once you get up to that generation, women outnumber men. But like I was saying before, it's a lot easier to raise your children in a sedentary context. We talk about settling down and having kids. Because if you're in a nomad tribe, that wouldn't occur to you. You'd raise your kids on the move.
We just got this email from Aliza in Laramie, Wyoming. I'm an RV girl, she writes, probably one of the younger solo female RVers out there. I left New York City in September 2000 in an old RV with my two chihuahuas and drove around the country for over a year. For a woman traveling alone, there were several factors that I had to consider for my personal safety that male travelers don't. One, campgrounds, where I can stay, where I cannot. State parks and parking lots were out for me because of safety concerns. Two, talking to strangers, I hardly ever did. Three, mechanics, learn how to speak to them. When I found a few honest ones out there, I was taken advantage of early on until I learned the lingo. Again, that from Aliza in Laramie, Wyoming. Good advice?
Excellent advice. I'm hopeless at talking to mechanics, too. I get taken advantage of.
Let's get another listener on the line. This is Chris, who's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I've walked across, using the National Scenic Trails, the Appalachian, the Pacific Crest, and the Continental Divide. I've done all three of those in the last 5 years. And what I've found is as you go, you actually start to build your own community in these smaller outlying areas with the ranchers and, in some cases, some of these mountain men. And you almost start to become more at home out there than you do in the cities. And you start to crave being out there. It is a, like I say, true freedom in the moment, not having outside influences pushing you in a direction. Instead, you're going with where you feel you should go, your natural instincts.
Hey, Chris, it sounds as if you've considered it at least once or twice that maybe you don't turn around, you just keep going.
Yeah, seldom do you ever turn around and go back. You take a different direction, but seldom do you go back in the same direction. It's almost kind of a rule, seems like.
Richard Grant, did you retrace your steps? Or you must have over the amount of time you've spent out.
Yeah, I mean, I've retraced I've been to the same place two or three times or whatever. But I think he brings up an interesting point that if you've, especially a wilderness trip, if you've gone on like a long wilderness trip and you've adjusted to it and you've really enjoyed it, I mean, so many of us have thought, oh, you know, I should just carry on forever. I'm happy. I'm surviving. Why not just carry on? And in my book, I tried to focus on people that had taken that plunge. They're like, okay, this is it. I'm cutting the ties to sedentary civilization. I'm going to make my life a wandering life.
And you never came quite to that point, Chris.
No, I have to work to come back and work. I'm married, and my wife has done two of these with me, and we've decided that with our children, we would like, instead of, you know, a normal one-week vacation in the future, when we have children, we would like to take a month every year and do a section of the country or of North America so that they can kind of get away from the everyday life and really kind of experience a more simpler lifestyle. And when I look back at pictures of myself, almost always smiling in the wilderness, and looking at it really brings back memories. And some of the strongest friendships now are people that I've met out there.
Where are you headed next?
I'm not too sure right now. Just working for the moment. Just got back from traveling, doing the Continental Divide last year in Australia, New Zealand. And so now it's settling down for a little bit.
Thanks very much for the call.
Yep, thanks.
Okay, an email on the point that Chris raised. How this from Kale Stedman, how does a generic suburbanite with wanderlust drop all the ties that root us down in our modern life? The dream is there, but it seems impossible in our world of bills and whatnot.
I guess it depends how badly you want to do it. Most people that wind up cutting those ties, do it because they just cannot stand the life that they've got already. It's just easier in a way to cut the ties than to stay. It's this pursuit of happiness, you know. I think people should pursue their happiness and think seriously about how they're going to get most out of life. And some people, that's a sedentary existence. Some people, it isn't a sedentary existence.
From your description of these nomads, there's clearly distinctions in terms of class. There are the people you describe riding around in RVs, that particular group of American nomads, and also a lot of people making it on very little money at all.
Yes, I mean the people in the $500,000 RVs and RVs in general tend to be people that have worked their life, sold their house at retirement and put the money into an RV. But if you've spent your whole life on the move, you're not going to have the kind of income that's going to support that standard of luxury or comfort. I mean, the most common way that people support themselves on the road is by buying and selling things, trading things. Setting up at flea markets, trading handicrafts. Some are more specific. I travelled with rodeo cowboys. Obviously, there's a living to be made there if you can stay on the back of the bull for long enough, and you don't get too stoved up by falling off the bull. But yeah, if you spend your whole life living out on the road, you're not going to attain the same level of comfort and luxury as you would living a settled life.
You were also certainly out there early enough to have encountered some of the deadheads who wandered around going from concert to concert, and I guess still do with bands like Phish.
Exactly, yeah. I went to, actually in the book I wrote about them at the Rainbow Gathering, which is a sort of big countercultural camp-out party in some different wilderness location every year. A lot of those people lived on the road year-round. A lot of them just showed up for the weekend. And there was a noticeable difference between the ones that were on the road year-round and the weekenders. And it did come down to, you know, basically how ragged they were.
We're speaking with Richard Grant. His new book is American Nomads, Travels with Lost Conquistadors, Mountain Men, Cowboys, Indians, Hobos, Truckers, and Bull Riders. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Here's a phone call now. Holly's with us from Durham, North Carolina.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling because I'm a former nomad.
And where did you roam, and how did you do it?
Well, I spent the years 17 to 20, that was my age, traveling around America by freight train. I guess I would fall into the hobo category.
I guess that's a hobo category. That's a difficult ambition for a young woman.
It was a very interesting time. I actually just decided I was going to get my midlife crisis out of the way because I didn't know what I was going to go to college for.
And why did you decide to, as the old expression goes, ride the blinds?
It was free. Illegal. I wouldn't recommend it for anybody. But free. I was a young girl. I didn't have a lot of money. And what it gave me was the ability to travel from one locale to another and really be a traveler instead of a tourist. Pick up odd jobs here and there and make money and keep moving.
And presumably stealing pies as they cooled on the shelves of in the windows of unsuspecting small-town American housewives.
Only if they smelled good.
It must have been a dangerous thing to do.
That's why I wouldn't recommend it. I've actually been concerned in the past couple years. I think MTV did a couple of specials on rail riders.
Uh-huh.
And it was very distressing to think that there were young kids watching MTV, maybe 14 or 15-year-olds who were unhappy with their lives.
As most 14 and 15-year-olds are.
Exactly, who could see these, and there's this romantic notion of hobos, and then there's MTV glamorizing it, and end up in a train yard and end up hurting themselves very badly or meeting the wrong type of person.
There's definitely some dangerous people out there you can run into on the rails.
Yes, very dangerous. And for me, if I was a religious person, I would think it was providence that I came out okay.
You must admit. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Richard.
Did you carry any sort of weapon or means of self-defense?
I carried a very big baseball bat.
All right.
Yeah. It was visible.
Along the way, though, you know, all of the people can't have been hostile. You must have met some interesting types.
Well, I think that part of what was part of the providence. I met some of the most brilliant people I've ever known in my life, and some of them seemed dedicated to a lifetime of just traveling, of riding rails, people that you just wouldn't encounter in a 40-hour-a-week suburban lifestyle.
Give me a for instance.
Hello?
Give me a for instance of somebody you met.
Oh, it's so hard. Different cities. There was a man who traveled around playing the one-string blues, and he could make more sounds come out of a one-string guitar than four musicians together.
Eventually, did you think at some point you were going to do this for the rest of your life?
Well, no. I was doing it while I was figuring out, I guess you could say, what I wanted to do. I wanted to see America. I wanted to learn more about myself. And now, although I'm settled down, I work, and I'm a full-time student, every time a train comes by, I have to stop and just watch it. But I never thought it was going to be a lifetime thing. Like I said, I was just getting my midlife crisis out of the way so that it didn't happen when I had a mortgage or when I had a car payment or children.
Was there one particular lure that drew you back into civilization?
My mother, my family, and my friends. I came back to my hometown because I think I had learned what I needed to. And I had also learned how unique and beautiful my hometown was.
Holly, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Holly calling us from Durham, North Carolina. When we come,
my hat is off to Holly.
Mine too. When we come back from a short break, we're going to continue our conversation with Richard Grant about his book, American Nomads. We're also going to be finding out about an artifact from the Lewis and Clark expedition 200 years ago, long thought lost and recovered in a bureaucratic mystery-solving story that you'll enjoy hearing about. I'll make up the rest of that when I come back from a break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest is Richard Grant, who's written a book called American Nomads. We're talking about the nomadic lifestyle in modern-day America. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Jerry, who's with us from Yankton, South Dakota.
Hi, Neil and Richard.
How you doing?
Good. I'm sitting here at my office at South Dakota Magazine, about two blocks from the Missouri River, the Lewis and Clark Trail. And I do a lot of traveling here in South Dakota in my job at South Dakota Magazine. But a few years ago when I was between jobs, I decided to drive down the longest road in the Americas, the Pan American Highway. So I bought a 1980 Dodge for $675 and headed down the road all the way from Canada to Panama, the only highway that goes all the way through, and I wrote a book about it. It's the only book ever written about this highway. It's called American Artery, A Pan-American Journey.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's one of the quintessential roads anywhere.
It is. It was the first international highway. It's Highway 81 through the United States. As a matter of fact, the Meridian Bridge, I can see from my window here, was the last link in that highway when it was finished in 1924.
And you would suspect that some parts of it are probably not as well maintained as parts of Highway 81.
As a matter of fact, Central America 1, which is the Pan-American Highway all the way through Central America, I had traveled it several times during the 80s, during the wars there, and it was in terrible shape then. But when I went back through in the mid-90s, there hadn't been any maintenance done, really, and there were pothole size or car-sized potholes. At one point in El Salvador, I had to drive in the ditch for a couple of miles as the best possible alternative. So, no, it wasn't very well maintained. I think it's a little bit better now.
Richard Grant, there are some people like Jerry who set off to accomplish certain tasks, certain feats. Are they one of the subcultures of American nomads, do you think?
No, it kind of gets into semantics. In a way, to be a nomad, when you reach a destination, it's in order to get what you need to move on to the next one. I would say that was more of a trip. myself, but I mean, I think it stems from the same impulse, the impulse to cut loose and travel and be free.
Get out of here, wherever that is.
Get out of here, wherever it happens to be.
In my case, I had lived my entire life somewhere along this road in several different states, and I decided I wasn't going to be able to escape it. And when I discovered nobody else had written a book about it, I decided that somebody ought to do that. And so, yeah, I had a goal in mind. One of the most interesting things I found was just I picked up lots of hitchhikers along the way, and I was real interested in what I could learn from each of them. That was particularly in Latin America.
I also picked up hundreds of hitchhikers.
Yeah.
Well, Jerry, thanks very much, and congratulations on the journey and the book.
Thank you very much.
And let's see if we can get another caller in. Sean, and Sean's with us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yes. Hello. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
I left home at 21, hitchhiked to Nashville, New York, went to Florida for 5 months, and that was kind of the beginning for me, but I still do this. I left in 2000, or 99 actually, for about 6 months in Montreal, Florida, Austin, Texas as far as I went, and then kind of came back to Florida and back to Wisconsin where I hail from, but now I'm in Louisville, Kentucky, and wanting to leave again very soon. In fact, a couple of weeks, kind of planning on. I have a trooper with a bed in the back, and I stay on waysides, and I'd really like to find more of this life because I can't want a house or want to settle down or feel good when I'm, you know, stationary. I don't want a regular job. I don't want, you know, I have no bills. I haven't had bills for many years now, and I live very comfortably, upper middle class. My girlfriend from high school is a physical therapist, and she's more than happy to support me. But
it sounds like an understanding woman.
Very understanding,
doesn't it?
And she doesn't want to see me leave. We've got twin 9-year-olds, and I'm, you know, kind of uncle daddy, but I'm daddy's nearby too. So, but she doesn't want me to leave, and I have to leave. I'm getting ready to go again. I'm going to go. I want to go west. I want to go down into the Baja of Mexico and have a look there, and then maybe up the coast. Where I was hitchhiked through in 79. I hitchhiked, caught one ride from Iowa all the way to Washington, Seattle area, saw the grave with Jimi Hendrix and blah, blah, and down the coast to Santa Barbara where I was married and had and my son in 1982 was born.
Richard Grant, I mean, from Sean's description, yes, there's the romance that you experienced and that I guess, you know, the compulsion that both of you share, but real sacrifices.
I'm scared. It's not romance. It's necessity. I don't really want to do this. But yet when I'm out there, I feel good. I feel stable. I feel hopeful. I can't understand cities. I can't understand Louisville. It's so huge. It's too big. I'm a country boy, but I don't like the country. I don't know. Wisconsin has its limitations, but, you know, traveling around is very lonesome. And to sleep in the back of my trooper in a wayside with earplugs in, listening to NPR to fall asleep is, you know, it's got its own scary horror to it that is very lonesome. And I hate myself at times for being out there, but I haven't found anything since. And like I say, I'm getting ready to leave again. But
Richard Grant?
I was just thinking that there's so few places in the world where you'd get these options. I mean, the thing about America is you can still go and do this. I mean, if you're in Europe, I mean, there's no public land. You'll get arrested if you sleep in a wayside. You know, the parks are all small. In America, you can still do it here. It's big enough and it's empty enough, especially in the western half, that you have this choice that I don't think you have. And certainly not in Europe. Maybe Australia. I'd like to get down there.
Sean, thanks very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Richard Grant, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Richard Grant, a freelance writer, the author of American Nomads, travels with lost conquistadors, mountain men, cowboys, Indians, hobos, truckers, and bull riders. He was with us from our bureau in New York.